What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We're going to spend an hour on Chicago today, where Trump's media blitz is in full effect. We're joined by my comrade and brother, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., the Black Panther Party Cubs, community-based organizer, activist, and son of the Black Panther Party leader, Chairman Fred Hampton. Good morning, brother.
Good morning, you as well, my sister.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are also joined by Iceland Pulley, my sister comrade, co-executive director of the Chicago Torture Justice Center, founded out of the historic 2015 reparations ordinance for survivors of Chicago police torture. Iceland is also the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Chicago. Good morning, Iceland.
Good morning.
Chairman X, I'm gonna start with you. Your initial response when you heard Chicago was next on Trump's list, were you expected or nah, or where was you at?
I could, you know, with these times, with these being reactionary times, you know, nothing comes as a surprise. But I can't say that, you know, that I expect Chicago to be next on the list. But these times, again, they're reactionary. Things are changing, I mean, day by day. In fact, I'm on my way back to Chicago as we speak, because I got to be on what we refer to as a political pivot, because you have to keep your guards up consistently. So I can't say I was, you know, I expected it. No, was I surprised.
Iceland, how about you?
Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't a surprise, because Chicago has been a target, and Trump has made, you know, no mistake by mentioning Chicago many, many times, even during his campaign. So we have been, you know, a sore for him. We, in 2016, I think it was, we kicked him out when he was trying to campaign for president the first time. We kicked him out of the city. Like, our protests were so massive. And so he has a grudge against us. He has a grudge against our movement organizing. And, you know, this has been something that he has wanted to do. He's wanted to punish us. He's wanted to punish the movement here for a long time.
I want to tug on a thread that wasn't initially in my script, but Chairman, you used the word reactionary. As an organizer, one of the things that I've been concerned about is on our side, that we've been reactionary. We're allowing the state to dictate our moves, even in some cases our analysis, not to mention people jockeying, right, for positionality in front of the camera instead of positionality to support the people through this, work with the people through this particular political moment. Your thoughts on the way the left is handling all of this right now?
Well, again, with the term reactionary, reality is it's a necessary ingredient for growth. I mean, we can harken back to the days of the Black Power movement in the 1960s. You had a climate, you know what I'm saying, the class peace under the Kennedy administration, and you had under the tenure of former U.S. President Richard Milhouse Nixon. In fact, I kind of refer to this climate as Nixon on steroids. But you had a dynamic, you know what I'm saying, where enforce certain conversations, certain responses to happen. And reality is in struggle. People get involved in struggle, become quote-unquote conscious or more progressive one of three ways: inspiration, aspiration, or desperation. So there are pros and cons, you know what I'm saying, to this dynamic, because in fact we say within the Black community in particular, in many cases heat turns more than meat black. So it's pros and cons to it, and there will be some mistakes made, but the deal is we have to struggle to look for even those mistakes and contradictions, that they be on our terms, because in many cases ironically, the same system that's oppressing us has been pulling the strings, the purse strings, or the controlling the political dynamics of how we move. We, as Malcolm X said, in self-determination, even our mistakes belong to us. So we, you know, so we have to welcome these, you know what I'm saying, not to say we're masochists that we look forward to, you know what I'm saying, to attacks, but to welcome them, you know what I'm saying, to be able to, again, to struggle on our own terms, inclusive of mistakes. So this era is terrible, but it's fine.
Thank you for that, Chairman. Eisen, you're free to respond to that as well. I have an additional question for you. Your mayor, Brandon Johnson, and I imagine Chairman's going to want to weigh in on this as well, has put into effect the strongest response we've seen from a mayor yet. He literally wrote an ordinance banning the Chicago Police Department from helping ICE or other federal agents. Howsomever, we know the track record of the Chicago Police Department. My understanding is, I've been watching this from afar, Chicago PD ain't too much of a fan of your mayor. What do you think will be the difference between what they are told to do and what they will actually do?
I think that's a wild card. They're used to following orders. And so what we saw over this weekend was they were following orders. And a lot of people on the ground got confused. And there were some comments on social media praising CPD. And it was like, nah, they're not, this is not something that they decided to do. They were following orders. So whether or not they continue to follow orders and to not, acquiesce to pressures from Trump and the like, with whom they are some big supporters of, CPD, and especially the FOP, are huge, huge supporters of Trump and have been since the very beginning. So whether they turn on that is to be seen. And that would be a huge development in terms of, the fight of the rise of fascism, right? Does the local police force then acquiesce to the fascist forces, and then by ignoring the bourgeois dictatorship protocols that are in place, right? That's like indicative of how fascism operates. So that's yet to be seen, and that will be an important development. Will they continue to follow protocol, or will they, sidestep that and in answer to the president instead?
Chairman.
Yes, indeed. Well, just tag team with Aston that pointed out, these are what we like to refer to as contested conditions. And you, what I mean by that is I speak about even myself being, when I was a former political prisoner, I commented that one of the best cellmates I had was an individual by the name of Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. I got to know who I was under those contested conditions. These are, a lot of times people, the protocol, the template is laid out, and in many cases, in particular the ruling class, it's never challenged. It's people just say, okay, this is how it goes, we operate. But so you have different dynamics, kind of like even with the Willie Lynch letter during chattel slavery, it was articulated that this is a foolproof method in how to run a plantation. He said, however, there are certain unplanned incidents, unplanned situations that you cannot predict. So there are certain dynamics that are occurring, again, the protocol, the executive mandate comes from the mayor's office in regards to how local law enforcement is not aligned with the National Guard when they come in. These are, in many cases, the state sentries. A lot of times you have like robots that say, okay, we get up in the morning, this is how we operate, so on and so forth. So we have to welcome these different type of contradictions, and keep our ear to the ground and wed marry theory and practice, look at take into account history, and you're going to see a lot of dynamics. Some people will be surprised, but again, you get to see who you are, who others are, what positions are being taken through these contested conditions.
Thank you for that, Chairman. Trump has used the increased crime narrative for Chicago as he has for other cities. However, just like in other cities, homicides and overall violent crime have been declining. In fact, the data shows, even his FBI's data shows, that Chicago had the safest summer in 60 years. My theory is that Trump is using that narrative, right, to exploit the fear of crime drumbeat that we saw sweep the country after the defund movement. My theory, making up a phrasing now, is that he is choosing cities based on histories of resistance, to your point, Iceland, right? So you want to establish dominance, you hit the biggest in the mouth. And Chicago, Los Angeles, and he's threatening Oakland, they're big mother, in terms of resistance. Now, maybe I'm giving the administration too much credit for strategy, but we know that what happens in Los Angeles and Chicago and your sister city, Oakland, impacts what happens around the country. Chairman, your thoughts?
Well, to your first point, It's always a historical tactic, crime catchphrase, emotional tugs, crime, sex. Those are dynamics that people can dismiss logic and just respond to. They can just say, you look at the history of lynchings, case of Emmett Till, so on and so forth. They can just throw this out, some sort of sexual crime happened, but just crime in general. It's been a blanket approach to implement that the system's going in, whether it be domestically or internationally. And I've often said that, if anyone believes that this system, in particular, is interested in stopping crime, you believe that Don King wants to stop boxing. You know what I'm saying? Because the reality is, not just resources, it's a necessary ingredient for capitalism. So that whole facade, that's a historical tactic. To your second point, there's some validity to that. You have political, certain places, imperialism implements strategic strikes, whether it be individuals, like attacking organizations, or even locate, geographically speaking, certain locations. When you talk about in Africa, Afghanistan, so on and so forth, those strategic strikes. And no doubt about it, they take into account the history, even if the people themselves are not cognizant of respective political history of their location. There are certain dynamics. You say, okay, if you break this person, if you break this location, it sends a message. And so, no doubt about it. So, even though, a lot of people look Trump takes it as a reactionary, but it's not a reactionary machine that's being served here. It's a machine that's armed with a history of the resistance and what triggers the poor, how colonized people have responded, what strikes to hit, to break the backs of potential resistance.
Thank you, Chairman Iceland.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And, we've been saying for years what happens in Gaza, what happens in Palestine, happens over here. And we've seen it in, little bursts where we were able to capture like the tear gas, like in Ferguson. And we were able to say, look, this is the exact same tear gas canister that they use in Gaza. And we're seeing how exactly what Chairman just said, we're seeing how they have practiced and fine-tuned and honed their skills. And that's what they're doing. These are testing grounds. They're also, it's also an intentional application of this particular ideology and plan, which they're setting forth. But the ultimate plan is to execute this nationwide. And by targeting these areas of the country that are known centers of organizing, a movement strongholds, that's purpose. That makes it easier then to carry it out nationwide. And it's also not, we would be remiss to not also acknowledge the fact that every single city that he has targeted so far has had Black mayors. And, so there's also the very clear white supremacist tone of this, which Trump has never hidden. And so that also is at play. There's the combined ramp up of capitalist crisis that makes fascism possible, coupled with the hopefully the swan song of white supremacy, who is trying to save itself in a world that is moving away from white supremacist control as a result of what we're seeing with the economies of China and India and other forces and in Africa. This threatens the whole hegemony of global capitalism that was built on white supremacy.
Yeah, I've been saying Black mayors, and I've also been saying, however, like large Black populations, because I don't know that I think it's the electeds they're targeting. Yeah. I actually think it's the masses that they're targeting, right? There's 100%. It's more establishment organizations, right, as they're thinking about defense plans for the invasions. They're worried about protecting, right, the folks that are elected in office. I'm like, nah, you need to identify the movement leaders. You need to identify, right, the strongholds of the masses. And we need to figure out defense strategies for those pockets. I think there's an opportunity for inside-outside organizing for sure. Chairman, I heard the mayor showed up at your event. And so that, like, there's some... Right, there's definitely some ways to work together, and I think we have to in lockstep. And And I know you both are aware of this. I'm preaching to the choir, right? There's got to be a street movement that ain't got nothing to do with what they're going to do in those halls of power. Chairman?
Yes, I would like to say at our event, because a lot of people, that was the annual Chairman Fred, annual, including yourself, I mean, including people outside of the Chicago area. This is the annual Chairman Fred Hampton Streets Party, in which every August 30th we acknowledge Chairman Fred Hampton's birthday. This year he'd have been 77 years old had he not been assassinated along with Defense Captain Mark Clark on December 4th, 1969. And a lot of people, what happened in 2004, we fought to have the street named in honor of Chairman Fred. And it was, it heightened a lot of contradictions. The fraternal police came out full force, and it was terrible but fine, because it exposed a lot of contradictions. Not just only with Uncle Sam, but also a lot of the Sambos. Not just with the Gringos, but the Negroes. What positions people took, so on and so forth. So fast forward, we were able to push this forward again this time, and it's under contested conditions. And I tell people, say, Chairman, you always talk about this. Why do you always put them in contested conditions? Not that I'm a masochist, not that we look forward, but we have to welcome those different dynamics. And people in the street sign was successful, the street that the Chairman Fred honored on. And a lot of people outside of Chicago may say, what was the big deal about a street sign? We say everything is political, including that of street signs. And Chicago has a history of giving everyone from you name it to Joe Blow a street sign. And heightened the conflict, people say, what is the significance? Why are they fighting against this dynamic about a street being on the Chairman Fred? And so it was a leap, you know what I'm saying, a revolutionary leap, you know what I'm saying, again, to even have that happen. And a lot of people say, well, congratulations to you and your family, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. I say, with all due respect, we have a term with the Black Panther Party Cubs. You say, Cub, congratulations. But to the people, because Chairman Fred was international representative of our people. That was a major blow, December 4th, 1969, to the colonized people throughout the world. And as you stated, I recommend people go look at the video footage of it. It was, I mean, the dynamics of, I mean, they crossed generational, geographical, and generational lines. Man, representatives from the Black Panther Party, not just here in the state of Illinois, but throughout the country were there. Baltimore, Philadelphia, the Pam Africa, the Move family, Breonna Taylor's aunt, different nationalities, different organizations, the streets, as well as that of elected officials, inclusive in particular that of Mayor Johnson, that was there. And it was not, and some people said, well, you have other situations where they come and appear. It's a different dynamic. It's a different energy. You know what I'm saying? There were different, even candidates running for different office who did not come with their petition saying, come vote for me, so on and so forth, came acknowledging this, not this individual, not in a subjective way, but acknowledging the contribution of Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton of the Black Panther Party and the Black Panther Party in general.
I'm going to tug on this thread a little bit more, Chairman. How do I want to ask this question? This, as you mentioned, I want to tug on the thread that this happened under contested conditions, that yes, at a time, right, where there is threats of federal invasion, at a time, yes, where actually, like, identifying yourself with revolutionary forces, right, is dangerous, right? Folks, yes, are being disappeared, yes, because of their political ideology. And yet this was, Field Marshal Terha Ox said, like, the largest street party that there has been. What does that say to you about the people's will to resist in this moment? What statement is that? To the forces, I don't want to call them the forces of the power, the state, I'm just saying the state.
Again, I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to give people the wrong impression. People say, damn, Chairman, you already talk about these contested conditions. You get to see who is who. Our Central Committee, Field Marshal Torhart, the heavies came, CRC, we had the freak, man. Oh, wow. We had the free gas giveaway, the free grocery giveaway. And it wasn't in a reactionary way. It wasn't just in Chicago. It was political buildup. As organizers, we smelt certain dynamics in play. And so I recall, you know, Central Committee meetings prior to this, where we were saying, Field Marshal Torrey, myself and others was talking about the buildup going through the Midwest with, you know, saying, with the CRC coming in from Gary, Indiana, Milwaukee. And a lot of people had tunnel vision. It was subjective. Like, what does that have to do with Chicago? Every, you know what I'm saying? And we anticipate certain dynamics. I recall prior to the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party. We smelled certain attacks coming to hijack that legacy. I said, okay, make sure we be on point for the 45th in Sacramento, the 46th anniversary, 47. Yes, yes. You recall?
I remember.
Yes, sir. Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't want to date us to how old we are. but to have the vision, to see these different dynamics as organizers, and a lot of times, in a lot of cases, people are reactionary to say, to be subjective, to say, well, just worry about this today, right now. We don't serve, we're not talking about no microwave meals. We're talking about putting the ingredients, the timing, and also the reader, as you just pointed out, it's important to put in what's happening, the present political climate, not just locally, but internationally, what's happening. And we have to seize the time. Because a lot of times you can pick out pockets and say, okay, that's just happening on the west side of Chicago. That's just the situation happening in Atlanta with the Department of Children and Family Services. No, you see a heightening of a discussion throughout the world. And it's terrible to find. And what some of the good fertilizer that can be picked up out of all this madness is that, say, points of unity, and recognize we cannot afford the luxury to have subjective, tripping, or I have an issue with this person. You've seen under some of the climates when Chairman Fred authored the Rainbow Coalition, which a few years prior, the climate may not have been conducive for it. But it's times like this that we have to up the ante in regards to scientific relationships, principal coalitions, and relate to the Black Panther Party position was that differences amongst the people are reconcilable. How the people in the state are irreconcilable. And with that being said, you have to also have a clear definition of who are the people? You see, even the ruling class, they're altering different definitions on conservative. You even in the different partisan political parties, people are jumping ship from Democrat to Republican. So these conditions are even finding out who they are. So, with that being said, is organized and the people in general get more of a concrete definition, because most of the definitions that we've been given have been state supplied. They have told us this is what it is to be this. This is what it means to be progressive. This is what this means to be with the working interests of the people. So we have contested conditions that say, hold on now. No, this is not. This is under contested conditions. We have to see who is who, including ourselves.
I just want to acknowledge that Kevin Fee, legal director for the ACLU of Illinois, has joined. We'll talk some legal stuff in a second, Kevin. Iceland, to Chairman's point, and every time I get to talk to you, you always do, you sort of like provide me the on-ramp for the next question, which is a conversation about, right, because we know that the divide and conquer, right, forever and ever, amen, is a tactic of the state. Some of our folks still fall for it. When the stuff in Los Angeles was happening, right, I'm watching nonsense on social media. This ain't got nothing to do with us. Let the dead say chickens coming home to roost, blah, 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 blah. Your thoughts, concerns about this moment in particular for Black people? Because what we've been working on here is trying to push what has been happening to Black communities under this Trump banner, including Black immigrants, which has been disappeared basically from the conversation.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I think is so, so important in this moment, is that when we talk about immigration, especially as Black folks, we have to know and we have to understand that the immigrants who are most severely targeted are Black immigrants. So we have Haitian immigrants, we have Jamaican immigrants, we have Belizean immigrants, we have immigrants from Nigeria, from Ghana, from Sudan, and these are the people who then get left out of the equation. And there's a right-wing trend happening in this country around nationalism, that somehow only the diaspora that landed here within the confines of this border of the United States matters, which makes no sense. Because the slave ships, they went from West Africa, they docked at in Puerto Rico, they docked in Cuba, they docked in the Bahamas. It makes no sense to have an allegiance to the borders of this land. And so we need to reject that. We need to reject that fiercely and understand that when we're talking about immigration as Black folks, we are also talking about Black folks. But in addition to that, we're also talking about people who have been incarcerated. Formerly incarcerated people are also being disappeared in this moment. And the attacks on people who are on the registries have ramped up over 400% since January 1, since Trump took office. And so we're seeing so many people get ramped up with being so-called out of compliance based on registries. And because there are over 70 law enforcement agencies in the city of Chicago and they don't communicate with each other, you can be registered as non-compliant on the state of Illinois website, but then CPD's records say that you are compliant, you'll still be taken. We've seen people also be arrested and deported as a result of that. So this directly affects Black folks. And if we have any illusion that somehow this is only an issue that that is related to immigration and people who have been born here or not born on this soil, then we are sadly, sadly mistaken. This is an issue that they are starting with. They're starting with immigrants. They're starting with targeting and specifically in Chicago, Mexican immigrants and Venezuelan immigrants, but they're not gonna stop there. They never stop there. We are right there. Black folks have been involved in these raids as well. And we need to understand that what is happening is part of the project of the colonial project of this country. And the colonial project of this country is to defend capitalism that is at its heart white supremacist. And so if we're not standing side by side with our undocumented family, then we need to be, because we need to know that just how they're coming for them, they're coming for us too.
I want to respect that you all were told that we would release you at 8:30. You are welcome to stay for the conversation, Chairman. I know that you are handling some important business right now. If you can stay, great. If you need to dip, I understand. And I knew that the two of you together was exactly the conversation that we needed to have.
I agree.
Great. So I'm gonna bring Kevin in the mix, and then Chairman, what I want you to mull over is specifically one of the things I respect about you, brother, is your deep relationship with the people. I've walked through on streets of Chicago with you, and, yes, and people, right? Hi, Chairman. Right, because of the way that you are of service, and accessible and consistent. And so I'm interested in the conversations or what messaging you're having with the people about this moment. So that's what where I'm gonna come to you next. Kevin, I have a question for you, and it's related to a question that I asked the two folks earlier, and that is Brandon Johnson, has done the fiercest or taken the strongest stand in terms of a response to Trump, and that's banning the Chicago Police Department from cooperating with federal agents. No one on this call, well, at least the three of us, are convinced the CPD is actually going to listen to that. What legal ramifications would happen? Like, what does it look like in the courts should they violate that ban?
Sure. So, yeah, the ban comes, just to sort of back up a step, the ban comes from a couple different places. There's a statewide law here called the Trust Act that prevents anyone in state government and state law enforcement from cooperating with federal civil immigration enforcement. So not criminal immigration enforcement, but sort of standard, what used to be standard anyway, enforcement of the civil immigration laws, detentions for, you know, essentially being a so-called illegal immigrant. And there is a welcoming ordinance in Chicago that kind of mirrors that. So, you know, so far the state and the city, as far as we can tell, have respected that line. They have not crossed it. They have not, you know, to their credit, aided ICE agents in their civil immigration enforcement. We're obviously going to be keeping a close eye on that, especially as, you know, additional federal forces get unleashed on our city, which looks like it will happen, you know, any sort of moment now, or maybe it in fact already has. But if there were a violation of that, you know, there could and would be the potential for lawsuits, you know, against the state for violations of the Trust Act, violations of the welcoming ordinance of the city of Chicago, that would, you know, come from individuals and outside groups. But, you know, it's certainly our hope that they'll respect that line. I totally understand the skepticism about CPD and their you know, their interests, but so far so good from our perspective. But we'll be keeping a close eye as things ramp up in the coming days.
Thank you, Kevin. Chairman, you're engaging with the folks right now. What's happening?
I feel a more in tune or more politically mature type of conversations starting to brew. Historically, in many cases, where you have to, as I speak about, like, even the black community in particular here, or just, in fact, in the U.S., one of the dynamics that we've been deprived of is a political maturity. It's, it breeds reactionary responses. And a lot of times, in cases such as this, when you have certain discussions happening, people have to say, wait a minute. I mean, I used the example when it was exposed about the treatment of the prisoners in Abu Ghraib, Baghdad, who was taken in Iraq. People that would open the door for discussing about political prisoners. In fact, it was one case where one guard, Grainer, who was depicted in the photos, how they were mistreating it. That's a euphemism, not mistreating the prisoners, but the atrocities that they were doing to the prisoners. And it came out that this same Grainer was a guard in SCI Green, long-held political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, is held captive at. So the disadvantage that we've been having is a non-acknowledged war waged on us. So now we have a discussion about, like, even so-called music. You know what I'm saying? How they're really propaganda bombs. Since this long Advocate One campaign in particular is the African anti-terrorism bill, the terrorism that goes down, you know what I'm saying, the black community worldwide, but in particular here domestically. And up the ante, as opposed to police brutality, police terrorism, and you see a dynamic now with the Trump to the National Guards, where even the images alone, if you're not clear, it's going to force you. This is political. You know what I'm saying? This is terms like Occupy Army. They may have seen distance, but they'll say, I don't understand what was Minister UEP talking about when he said Occupy Army. Oh, you seen it in a raw, uncut. So it's more of a politically mature, even though in many cases it's reactionary, but it's forcing a more politically progressive type of discussion. In fact, Lenin has said that what takes people 20 years to learn in ordinary times, they can learn in 2 years in revolutionary times.
Thank you, Chairman. Kevin, I'm going to direct this question to you, and then Iceland, Chairman, I'm actually interested in your thoughts as well. This administration, this president, has thumbed his nose at the courts, right? The courts said, you can't. He says, yeah, I can, right? I mean, his administration literally flew a plane full of people that the court said he wasn't allowed to fly out of, deported them illegally to a country that they were not from. Some of the rooms that I was in at the beginning of his second regime, The question was, what political tools are still available to us, right? Because clearly we cannot keep, it's different political conditions. Every organizer knows you gotta shift strategy if the political conditions shift. I've had some questions about the legal lever. And in this moment with a dude that, like, the law means nothing to him, or as far as he's concerned, he is the law. Are the courts still a valid place of resistance? If so, why? And what concerns as an attorney do you have about, I mean, we even saw in California, right? There was the ruling. The federal agencies cannot do this, but because the way he's stacked the Supreme Court and the federal circuit, it just got overturned and on he marches.
Yeah, it's a fair question, and it's an alarming time. And there's no doubt that, we are, if we're not in a constitutional crisis, we're approaching one. And there's been, as you said, instances of flagrant, thumbing of executive branch's nose at the judicial branch. And that's a frightening place to be. I would say, though, that, the courts are still, in my view, in my opinion, a place of real resistance. And while it is the case that some of these court orders have been ignored, and those are the ones that tend to get the most attention, many of them have not, and so far, cannot be ignored. And I don't think that we should underestimate the impact of this broad web of injunctions on the way that this administration has operated. In some corners, the line is holding. There's injunctions in place. I mean, just to use the example out of Los Angeles, which is was a terrible interim ruling for democracy, in my view, yesterday. In that intervening time, there was a court order in place that restricted the actions of agents throughout the state and throughout the country for fear of being held in contempt of court. That's real. That was real. It had an actual impact on enforcement activities. on people who might have otherwise been swept up. And so, you know, getting that injunction, securing it was, in my view, worthwhile and impactful, even if ultimately, you know, we have to sort of fight on another front now with this new ruling that's come down. Although even the new ruling that's come down is sort of an interim emergency ruling that doesn't fully explain itself and leaves a lot of room for interpretation and, you know, additional sort of litigation on the margins of that order that I think could be helpful to people. So the federal courts are in a lot of ways, especially the lower courts, doing their job. They have enjoined dozens and dozens of illegal Trump policies. Some of those injunctions have been overturned. Some of them have not been overturned. You know, I mean, the blatant attack on the 14th Amendment that was the administration's attempt to end birthright citizenship, that was halted by the courts, you know, and thank goodness it was, because otherwise you'd have, you know, a generation of kids born stateless in this country. But because of the court order, you know, that's still on hold. I share your concerns with and skepticism of the Supreme Court, but, you know, in my view, we've got to keep fighting, and the courts are one of the places where we can best do that.
It's an interesting position for folks like me and Iceland, and I believe Chairman too. Like the contradictions here in this conversation, in terms of our political ideology and beliefs and what's happening on the ground, are really present for me right now. Iceland, your thoughts? What tools are still available to us? What shifts do we need to make? Are the courts still a valid lever that we need to pull? Have they been effective historically for us?
I think that the law follows power. And so it's a reflection of where the dominant hegemony is. So, you know, pre-1865, the slaveocracy was the economic engine of this country. And so the laws allowed for slavery to be legal. I think what we're seeing right now is we are experiencing a very important crisis of capitalism that is happening within this country and globally. And so the rules are changing, and we're seeing Trump do that. And he's one pivotal and important player in the game that is trying to redefine what the terms of what acceptable terms are. I think also to Chairman's point, what he's doing in addition to utilizing the courts it is also a grand political theater, right? And so there's, you know, his pomposity has a purpose. It has an effect on the population. It both riles up his base and then can also serve to empower us to act in opposition. But a lot of what he does is the political theater component of it, which serves as a beacon call and a dog whistle to his very, very violent and right-wing conservative and racist base. And so I think we're seeing a few things happening with Trump, right? There's a legitimate attack on the legal system, which is a part of trying to rewrite the ship of capitalism. Can capitalism reconfigure itself into some form of stability out of the crisis that it's in? And what will that new terrain look like? The version of capitalism that we have been living under is largely the byproduct of the Great Depression and the revolutions and independence movements that happened subsequent that, with the rise of the global South overthrowing colonial rule, right? And so then that pushed us into the type of capitalist order that we have. And those rules are being rewritten right now because the terms are being rewritten. The wars in Gaza, what is happening right now with Israel and Palestine is incredibly important. And so all of that is being worked out in the field and in a real way where our power is always in the movement and in the people and in the street. And so we need to remain there. That's where our struggle is. The law will follow that. We can, you know, use it as a tool when it makes sense, but it will, like how I view electeds and law, is that they follow power. And if our power is supreme, then we are going to push forward developments that will serve the whole of humanity, and it will deepen freedoms. If we are not successful, then there will be significant more atrocities that are experienced by the hands of the state. And so this fight that we're in will require us to use many tools, and the law is one of them, definitely. But as organizers with the people, our power is with the people on the ground.
Right on.
Chairman.
Yes. In regards to the legal apparatus is the deal is, the reality is that we're in a community that we're not afford the luxury a lot of times to get the Home Depot or the tools at a Menard. A lot of times we gotta work with, you know what I'm saying? And we gotta have, as organizers, keep our ear to the ground and look historically, whether it be Reverend Nat Turner's church, Harriet Tubman's Negro Spirituals, or Geronimo with the natives, using what they refer to as the ghost dance. And you know, and this, to put in context, let's be clear, in this country, slavery was legal. And the law, in many cases, I think it was Minister UEP Nunes said that, you know, many cases in our community, the Constitution is nothing more than pagan poetry. It sounds real good. And as we're at the time, we're at the stage in the game, you know what I'm saying? Well, again, consciousness is being heightened. And, you know, though Trump is a poster child in the face of this, but again, we look at the history. You know, I'm thinking about countless of cases, you know, with brothers and sisters were locked up. They clearly in their cases. You say, wait, this is illegal. This is, and you go back to the court and say, this is against the law. This is what you were saying, and it's been a norm. And to draw that analogy, I think comedic genius Richard Pryor said that a lot of, you know, in many cases, the white community may go through the black community. They may see people in our community with needles or drug residue around our nostrils. And they said, that's a shame. They come home and their sons and daughters on the front porch with a can of Budweiser beer. They said, oh my God, it's an epidemic. So we're at a stage in the game now that people are seeing it's an epidemic of imperialism that's been going down. I mean, how the atrocities with the law historically, how it's been utilized. This is a Machiavellian system. Frederick Douglass said, you know, this peculiar institution, you know, it will change its name. So we've been through, whether it's been chattel slavery, sharecropping, redlining, all these different dynamics with this system was able to say, okay, here, let's dress it up, throw some Latin terms on it, say, okay, this sounds real good. I think we should seize the time, heighten the contradiction, to recognize again that everything is political. You know, so whether it be music, different dynamics, including that of the law. And that's political. And again, and I fall for the facade that change comes from trickles down from the top down, but again, from the ground up, So we got to really, you know, hold the line and struggle to be very clear and grab whatever concessions that come through, you know, throughout the law. As France Fanon has stated, to be able to accept the concessions without compromising our principles, and our principles will be the survival and the self-determination of the people.
Thank you, Chairman. Kevin, how do you, in what ways do you mount a legal offense for this moment? How do you, from where you sit, knowing what's coming or having an idea of what's coming, none of us know, but we can make some assumptions based on what we've seen. How do you do that, particularly in a city like Chicago? I'd ask you the same question if you were here in Oakland, where there is such strong community organizing on the ground, and the leadership in terms of how to respond to this moment is going to come from the streets.
Sure. And you know, I just want to sort of pick up on some of the ideas that you know, I just heard and agree with. You know, I heard law sort of discussed as a tool, and I think that that's a good way of looking at it, you know. And I think that our job as lawyers is different, and sometimes than jobs of organizers. And you know, our job is to use the tool to the best of our abilities. And the tool does sometimes work, you know, even in a system as imperfect and flawed as the American justice system is. You know, you can use the law to affect real change. If you get an innocent person out of jail using the law, it worked, right? Even though the system itself may be fundamentally flawed in individual instances, you can use it to make change. And that's sort of what we try to do. And in this particular moment, you know, as hard as it is, given the full frontal attack on our basic constitutional rights that we're seeing come out of this administration, we just remain guided by that same Bill of Rights that, you know, to this point has not been repealed by this administration as much as they act as if it has. Folks still have First Amendment rights. They still have Fourth Amendment rights. They still have Fifth Amendment rights to due process. We bring habeas petitions for immigrants who are detained without due process and try to get them released. Sometimes we're successful. You know, we bring lawsuits under the Fourth Amendment based on racial profiling in ICE arrests. Sometimes they're successful, like they were in Los Angeles. Sometimes they get overturned. Although, you know, what happened yesterday wasn't technically an overturning. It was a supposed pause. It's a setback, you know, but then we keep fighting and we look for the gaps in that ruling. And we continue to push forward with Fourth Amendment principles and use them. You know, we continue to file lawsuits based on people's First Amendment rights. You know, in Los Angeles, there was very real targeting of the press. We were trying to just do their constitutional duty in covering protests against the unlawful ICE actions that they saw around them. They were targeting the press with projectiles, rubber bullets, beanbags. You know, they were bruised and bloodied after they just simply tried to cover these protests. And there was an injunction that was sought from a court and granted preventing those kinds of tactics from agents when dealing with the press moving forward. You know, immigrants have been snatched off the streets because of their advocacy in favor of, you know, justice in Palestine, and had their, you know, the administration attempting to revoke their immigration status. We got those folks released using lawsuits. So it's going to be, you know, a constant effort to use the constitutional rights that remain in our toolbox to advance litigation on behalf of vulnerable people. And, you know, the hope is through a combination of that legal work and broader political change, you know, we can make a real difference moving forward. That's the hope.
Thank you, Kevin. Chairman Fred, I see you on the move and we're coming to the end of the hour. I want to give you 60 seconds for closing statements. Anything you want to say?
Well, I just want to say a revolutionary appreciation for this panel. Respect to you, Ace and Kevin. I'm sure we're going to be seeing each other a lot more, you know what I'm saying, with this times. Again, this is a needed, necessary discussion. We need, you know what I'm saying, not only the discussion, but also tied in with the continuous work that I'm sure all of us are doing and going to continue to do. Respect. I'm going to, I think I got to go to Ferguson, Canfield, Missouri also, because this case about Dorian Johnson, the young brother who's with Michael Brown Jr. when he was murdered. And they, you know, the first response they sent was a domestic case, but call me politically paranoid, whatever, you know what I'm saying. We refer to it as a people's investigation. So I'm going to go down there also to put my ear to the ground what's going on. But again, we have to tie all these different dynamics. Everything is political. Free them all and revolutionary respect for having me on.
Free them all, Chairman. Safe travels to you. Keep us posted on what's happening down there.
Yes, definitely. Okay, Aston, I'll see you soon, Aston. Right on.
Thanks.
All right. Right on.
Okay. Aislinn, closing statements, 30 seconds.
We got to organize. Our responsibility is with the people, and we will not succumb to pressure. We will not succumb to fear. We will continue fighting, and we will continue fighting for the rights of all of us, and we will win.
Kevin, 30 seconds.
I like that. I think that there's nothing we can do in this moment except fight. And it can be, it's really tempting sometimes to be resigned to things just continuing to deteriorate and, you know, the normal channels being closed off to us and the law not working. But I truly believe that the law is and remains an essential tool for advancing social justice. There are things we can continue to do. There's ways that we can continue to fight this administration's assault on our basic liberties, and we intend to keep doing that.
I appreciate y'all coming on the show. I'm going to be tracking this. We're going to ask you to come back. Free them all, power to the people. Talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.